Please be aware that this podcast has reference to drug and alcohol use and paraphernalia and may not be appropriate for some people in early recovery. Everyone, my name is Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And we hope you are enjoying our Treat Addiction podcast. The information in this podcast cannot replace your seeking a treatment provider, which you can easily do at SAMHSA's National Helpline at findtreatment.gov or 1-800-622-4357.
So it seems like we're covering the gamut of addictions. We've discussed opioids in our last focus on alcohol addiction. Where are we going next?
Sadly, there's a lot of addictive substances and issues out there, and I wanted to go with the predominant ones first. Opioids and alcohol kill at epidemic levels, so we got them covered. Today, we will discuss stimulants like amphetamines, cocaine, and ecstasy, and what they call synthetic cathinones or bath salts.
I remember you mentioned that in your experience, cocaine and OxyContin were really addictive. And in fact, I was just thinking as I'm reading and thinking about this that when I first started practice, cocaine was the beast.
It was.
It was the beast.
For the longest time.
And one gentleman, he said to me that the money he spent on cocaine, he could have purchased several houses, several cars, and been on many vacations. Most of his money, he worked for one of the car companies here. He just spent it all on cocaine.
And you won't believe it, you know, in one of the patients that I treated was a gentleman from Chicago. He'd come all the way to Toledo for the anonymity that Toledo would afford.
Wow.
And he was in the mafia. And
And he was your patient.
And he was he was addicted to cocaine. It's a really, really tough drug. And I noticed that those who use cocaine, they have the memory of cocaine and subsequent addiction. And staying sober from the cocaine can be really quite difficult, more so because we do not have a targeted. We'll discuss the treatment. But, you know, just like we have a Suboxone for opioids, it's not particularly targeted for cocaine. And it's estimated that cocaine has been used by approximately 20 million people worldwide. And a U.S. population-based survey estimated that in the United States, 5.5 million individuals were current, meaning past year, cocaine users.
I was remembering just now reflecting on a discussion I had with an ER physician one night when I was on call. And often individuals coming down cocaine may have suicidal ideation, so they'll call us to come assess them.
Right.
And we were talking about some other patients literally will tell us things like, this is like the best orgasm you can ever conceptualize, the use of cocaine.
Right.
So it really is very, very powerful. So we have some idea now from what you've just shared, the extent of the problem. But what are some of the risk factors for cocaine use disorder?
So it's higher in males and people who are single. And in terms of substance use, tobacco, alcohol, and cannabis increase the risk. Also, smoking cocaine increases the risk for addiction because smoking makes a substance, be it cocaine or anything else, reach the brain very quickly. And if you remember, that's the thing that creates and reinforces the addiction for the patient. And if the amount is high or cocaine is used frequently, the chance of addiction is obviously higher. But I will let you, our in-house psychiatrist, Dr. Ketley Daniels, talk about the psychiatric risk factors.
Well, there seems to be a higher prevalence in those with antisocial or borderline personality disorders, but also in those with ADHD, especially if they've been diagnosed as children. Yes. A very important risk factor is what we call adverse childhood experiences, also known as ACE. It's more likely to these individuals are more likely to develop issues with cocaine as adults. That said, we hear lots of times people saying things like, my genes made me do this. So what is the relationship between genes and cocaine use disorder?
It's pretty strong, actually, with cocaine use disorder. And the heritability is pretty interesting at 65 to 79%, though multiple genes, of course, are involved.
That's pretty high.
Yeah.
That's pretty high. So how do people typically use cocaine?
So it's mainly smoked, snorted, or injected. And like we mentioned, smoking causes the cocaine to reach the brain very quickly, and it increases the chance of addiction.
Do you remember the commercial once upon a long time ago? They had a room and they had somebody walking around in the room saying, I do cocaine so I can work harder, so I can do more coke, so I can work harder. And the person just went round and round.
Mm.
It was a good commercial because that high was so powerful, it just kept them on this loop.
Mm.
What does a high from cocaine look like?
So the person could have a lot of energy, be real talkative, alert, happy, with a decreased need for sleep. There can be loss of appetite, weight loss, and in some people there's restlessness and repeated what we call stereotypical behavior, like picking one's skin. And I think because it's your expertise, you should talk about the psychiatric effects.
Well, in psychiatry, we also see more issues with anxiety, suspiciousness, paranoia, impaired judgment. Yes.
Isn't there grandiosity as well? Because I remember that saying that alcohol users minimize and cocaine users maximize, because cocaine gives them this sense of grandiosity that they exaggerate.
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe we should also look at the withdrawal symptoms out of the way. They're rarely medically serious, and it's mainly eating and sleeping a lot. And initially there's insomnia, but later on people do sleep a lot, right?
Yeah, they do. And they go into what we call a cocaine crash, in which there's slowness of thought and slowness of movement. What we call psychomotor retardation in medicine, and severe depression and suicidal thought, because from that high, they go into this terrible low.
Yeah, and we saw that, in fact, when I was mentioning earlier, doing inpatient work, that often these individuals will come in crashing and absolutely despondent and suicidal.
Correct.
And then, of course, they send them to the psychiatric unit. We would assess them. And then 2, 3, 4 days later, they were now ready to get back to work and get back to life again. But those are some of the withdrawal symptoms of cocaine. What happens if people use cocaine chronically or long-term?
So we see patients having seizures, stroke, cognitive disorders, like memory disorders, movement problems, headache. And this is really a story of a 36-year-old who I have never forgotten, or which I've never forgotten, very educative. He'd come in for a follow-up visit for methadone, and I saw that his arm was in a sling. And I figured he'd broken it, and so I asked, and he said, no, he could not use his arm because it was paralyzed because of a stroke, and that since that time he was carrying it in a sling, and that the stroke was because of cocaine. It was just very stunning to see that. In the same way that people get high blood pressure, heart disease, and heart attacks, and collapsed lung, there's another thing that people go through called the cocaine bugs hallucination, in which they scratch and pick at their skin. And there are so many psychiatric effects of chronic cocaine use that I think that you want to elaborate.
Well, the risk of developing cocaine use disorder is higher, as we said earlier, with people with certain personality types and ADHD, but also for those with generalized anxiety disorder. The risk of developing cocaine addiction is higher in those with lifetime of major depression. And you can imagine why that would be, because it's a stimulant. And there is an 11 to 28% lifetime prevalence of bipolar disorder among those individuals with cocaine use disorders. 7 to 10% lifetime prevalence of cocaine use disorder among those individuals with schizophrenia and spectrum disorder. So it's very much an integral part of what we treat. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And perhaps from cocaine, we can go on to talking about methamphetamine use disorder, made famous by the very addictive series Breaking Bad. It was such a production.
I remember starting out, but I couldn't continue watching the series. It got really dark really fast. I remember it.
But very addictive.
But it was.
I binged on
intended.
It. Yeah, no pun intended. Very, I binged on it.
It seems that it is one of the fastest rising drugs worldwide, though.
It is, and it is most often smoked or snorted, less commonly injected or taken by mouth. It's greatly favored by students worldwide because it increases energy and alertness and decreases the need for sleep.
And yes, that famous meth mouth, in which the dryness caused by the meth causes a lot of tooth decay. I've had several people, in fact, even some of those with opioid addiction who also had, you know, comorbid issues with meth.
Right.
Young women.
Yes.
Having to have dentures. Young women.
That was a shocker to me. Seeing patients who were like 30
yes.
with dentures.
With dentures.
Would make me want to fall off my
yes.
chair. It was
yes,
like
yes,
a real,
yes.
a real terrible awakening.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of psychiatric issues with stimulants, yeah?
Yep, yep. Chronic use can cause many mood issues, including irritability, anxiety, aggression, panic symptoms, suspiciousness that can lead to frank paranoia, hallucinations, memory problems, you name it, yes.
And overdose deaths from methamphetamine are rising again, and there's an increased risk of early death and suicide attempts, and a growing risk of fatal overdose from contamination with fentanyl. So
yeah.
sad.
It is very sad. And then there is the methamphetamine intoxication.
Yeah, there is. And it is potentially life-threatening because of the severe high blood pressure and fast heart rate, severe agitation and psychosis that methamphetamine intoxication causes. The person can go into shock. The body temperature can become really high, which can result in kidney failure. The situation can be so difficult that the person with severe agitation and high blood pressure and high fever can need to be placed on a vent.
Wow. You know, as we're talking about this subject, it makes me sad to think that there are those out there listening to this podcast who will not alter their trajectory. They will still use these products in spite of what can happen to them.
This is the thing with addiction.
Yeah.
That if they like that high, they keep going back.
They keep going back. Mm. Since we're on the subject of stimulants, we need to look at amphetamines and bath salts as well.
Yeah, your amphetamines are your typical ones that people know well, like Adderall, Ritalin, Vyvanse, ephedrine. And sometimes something we never came across before, like you were talking about that when in the earlier days when we dealt with addiction, it was cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
But now it went on to, and alcohol has always been there, but mm-hmm. then it became the opioids. But now we have come across what they call bath salts, mm-hmm. which are a synthetic form of amphetamines. And which are completely unregulated.
Wow.
So you can just get them from your, you know, local store.
Online, and they can
yeah.
get all kinds of things.
Exactly.
And, you know, incidentally, we find in our office that I treat a lot of people for ADHD. Seldom do we have issues with abuse from the individuals who have ADHD with their medications. So if you have someone who's abusing it, it makes you pause and consider what's their real diagnosis. The main issue we have is diversion. They will just,
right,
they
right.
might sell it, they do other things with it. But those who need it, they take it appropriately. Those who do not, they begin to abuse it, yes. So what happens in amphetamine intoxication?
So it's basically what we call the sympathetic system of the body going on overdrive. So you have a fast heart rate, high blood pressure, fever, sweating, large pupils, and severe anxiety and agitation, sometimes violent behavior, and sometimes seizures.
So what distinguishes bath salts from the others then?
They're all stimulants, but the thing with bath salts is their prolonged duration of action.
So before we go on to treatment, maybe we should take a look at one more product, which is MDMA or ecstasy?
So ecstasy is synthetic, and the interesting piece is that it works both as an amphetamine and like mescaline, which is an hallucinogen. So you get two bangs with one buck. Its niche is party goers and people at dance clubs and festivals. The typical effects are feeling of euphoria, alertness, and intimacy, together with what we call disinhibition, which is typical of alcohol. You know, like people just can, they're different people when they're drunk versus when they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And they can have a significant personality change because now they're all talkative from being really quiet people.
And you can see why someone who is shy, someone who is an introvert or they, well, anxiety especially, you can see why they need something like a product like that to loosen them up in certain social situations. But there are consequences. This product, though, it's very toxic, isn't it?
It is. And the sad part is, like with the bath salts, that they're not controlled and their concentration is not monitored. So the person does not know really how much they're taking, mm-hmm. and it can result in death.
Ecstasy can also cause severe high blood pressure, high fever, delirium, agitation. There are life-threatening complications also, like bleeding in the brain, heart attacks, seizures, and muscle breakdown.
Yeah, and that said, maybe we should go on to the treatment of these stimulants.
In behavioral management of stimulant use disorder, we recommend individual counseling. That's always one of the foundational recommendations for me is the counseling. We have individual counseling, group counseling, and if there is a partial or no response, then they may require more intensive treatment, like the IOP we mentioned earlier, where you go in 3 days a week into a program that focuses on the substance use disorder. And then there's contingency management, like CBT and other treatment. We recommend those, yes.
So what are the, I've noticed all through that the primary treatment is psychosocial.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the benefits of the psychosocial treatment of stimulant use disorder?
Well, we find that there are lower rates of treatment dropout and reduction in use of stimulants in some studies. But psychosocial approach to management of these disorders, you have the support, which is absolutely crucial to maintaining abstinence. But what if social treatment, psychosocial treatment does not work? What's your next recommendation?
So we call it pharmacologic augmentation or adding medication. So that when psychosocial treatment by itself doesn't work, then we need to add medication to try to see if it does, noting that unlike opioid use disorder in which you have targeted medications like methadone and Suboxone, that does not apply in stimulant use disorder. So, but there are some, like with cocaine, we use topiramate or Topamax. It can work well in some patients. If that doesn't work, we use long-acting amphetamines like Ritalin LA, can be tried. I'm not a fan because you're going from one stimulant to the other addictive stimulant, and or Adderall XR.
And I find, too, sometimes that the dopamine medication like Wellbutrin really works nicely. But as I said earlier, I'm a fan of gabapentin. And then, I don't know, I tell folks sometimes that we have to come up with a cocktail that helps with the symptoms they're having.
Right, yes.
And then as long as we can keep it under control, that's the goal. And we go into our goodie box and find something that helps them.
Yes, yes.
So are those the only choices? Do we have anything else? Meaning, what if even these don't work?
I've had a lot of luck with modafinil for cocaine use disorder or Provigil, which is used for shift work sleep disorder. And studies show that a common antidepressant like citalopram or Celexa has kept patients abstinent from cocaine, but at a higher dose.
At a higher dose,
at 40 milligrams.
Yeah, and they work very nicely and they're very well tolerated. The treatment for MDMA or ecstasy is a bit different, yes?
Yes, like you just mentioned, bupropion or Wellbutrin, taken as 450 milligrams daily and naltrexone injected at 380 milligrams is effective for MDMA addiction. And if this is not effective, then mirtazapine or Remeron is can be tried.
And unfortunately, unlike opioid use disorder and alcohol addiction, we do not have as many targeted medication for treatment with these stimulants, the cocaine, amphetamines, or ecstasy, right?
Yeah, and because the primary treatment of stimulant use disorder is behavioral, it really serves well because it gives the patient, it almost compels the patient to understand their disease and take counseling and the various, like whether it's CBT or individual counseling, to take that seriously.
Mm-hmm. And I do find that when you have a therapist or a physician that you can connect with for support, it is invaluable towards maintaining sobriety. It does work. So what's in store for us in the next episode?
So I kind of like figured that we have lots of choices, but I was thinking of doing psilocybin or magic mushrooms because it appears that they're gaining a lot of popularity in the United States. And we'll also talk about the concept of microdosing, because it really sounds very interesting.
Well, it's not just fashion. It sounds like drugs are becoming even more and more fashionable. But, you know, I think in our culture right now, I'm finding that a lot of people need something, a crutch to lean on so that they can make it through every day, because it seems like there's so much more stress these days.
Exactly.
So there are a lot more that we're going to be able to talk about, I'm sure.
There will be, and I think our audience is going to be quite fascinated by the concept of microdosing, in which we, as physicians, we think of addiction with large doses that the patient takes.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a good number of people that are taking minuscule doses in which they're just kind of like experimenting, mm-hmm. just like with a little bit, and mm-hmm. it kind of apparently does a great deal for them. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to, you know, go into that episode because I think the audience will really enjoy it as well.
I agree.
We really hope that you're enjoying our podcast series. Please subscribe and share the podcast with family and friends. You can listen on wgte.org/treataddiction or anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Treat Addiction. It is only through awareness and education that we can tackle the very treatable disease of addiction. I want to thank my co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels, for a great discussion today. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am your co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And our executive producer is the very talented Chris Pfeiffer. Until the next episode, and actually always, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always. We hope to meet again real soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.